Hey everybody, welcome back to Sock Monkey Sound, Music and Culture Podcast. My name is Chip Copeland, and on this episode, which I'm really excited to present to you today, is an interview that I did with a band called Death. Before Bad Brains, before the Sex Pistols or the Ramones, these guys, three teenage brothers, they formed a band and began playing music in a spare bedroom of their Detroit home. It was David, Bobby, and Dennis Hackney. They recorded some demos, they played a few gigs, pressed a single on their own label, even Triangle Records. I mean, these guys were punk, you know, pre-punk, proto-punk, whatever you want to call them. You know, back then it was just rock and roll. So these guys, they put out their own music on Triangle Records, just a single, and they also did some recording in a professional studio as well, funded by Clive Davis. And he was really only interested in the band if they changed their name. So the brothers, they thought about it, and they decided to turn down the offer. So, you know, had they accepted that, they might have, you know, actually reached a wider audience, but they would have compromised their vision as well. And eventually the band, they disbanded, and but the legend of the group grew. In the age of the internet, and copies of the single that they had self-released started to get sold on eBay and started circulating through the musical underground, you know, and around the time when blogging started to become a bigger thing, the music started to, people were ripping the singles, putting it up online as MP3s. It started to reach a new generation of music fans that were more receptive to the sounds, you know, kids who had grown up with punk and hardcore and garage, along with your traditional rock and roll, they started to see the value in what these kids from Detroit were doing. So, you know, fast forward a little bit, and Bobby Hackney Sr., his son Bobby Hackney Jr., discovered this band called Death through a friend. And come to find out, it's his dad's old band with his uncles. So that's the story in a nutshell. But the thing is that now there's a movie. There's a documentary. It's a band called Death, directed by Jeff Howlett and Mark Corvino, and it's bringing the Hackney story to a wider audience. I had the pleasure to speak with Bobby Hackney Sr., Dennis Hackney, and current guitarist Bobby Duncan about the story and the music that inspired them and their late brother David Hackney, who passed away in 2000. So I began the interview by asking the band how it felt to see the story of Death and also their family told on the big screen.
Really beyond, you know, beyond what we had envisioned.
Yeah, you know? I mean, you know, who knew that Death would wake up from the grave and everybody would be able to comfortably say it without turning their head or, you know, making some other kind of funny gesture. So, I mean, you know, it's really kind of surreal for us.
Yeah, I guess times have changed where people aren't nearly as, there's not as much of a stigma associated with the word death, you know, especially after punk rock, you know, and a lot of people, you know, you know, death is being branded as proto-punk, and, you know, after punk, you know, there's bands of all kinds of names that you just don't want to say sometimes.
Yeah, I know. You know, it's funny because when we was creating and writing and producing this music and performing it, we didn't call it punk. I mean, back in 1974, if you call somebody punk, and we've said this many times, you know, you got a bloody nose. Those are fighting words. And so, you know, a Memphis guitar player told us that one thing that he thought that made our story so incredible was that we had no idea at the time that we were laying down the groundwork for what they call punk music. which is very true. We didn't call it punk music. We just called it hard driving Detroit rock and roll. You know, we wanted to be like the MC5, you know, like Grand Funk Railroad, Alice Cooper, The Who, you know, Bob Seger. You know, we wanted to be like, you know, Mitch Ryder, the Detroit Wheels, all the great rock bands that were coming out of Detroit.
Right. Yeah, that's my uncle was actually, he was a DJ back in Detroit in the late 60s and early 70s, and he was actually at the MC5 show where you first heard that, you know, kick out the jams, motherfucker. And I, you know, talking to him about that, you know, he said that, you know, it was just a electrifying experience to be in that crowd and to also, you know, just experience that raw power of the rock and roll scene at the time.
Yeah, exactly. That's what, you know, I mean, hey, Detroit was a wonderful... See, Detroit is known as two things. It's known as Motown, of course, but it's also known as Detroit Rock City. And ironically, the band that pinned that took that phrase and pinned it to a song was a band called Kiss. But it was always called Detroit Rock City if it wasn't called Motown. And we used to remember, you know, I mean, driving up Jefferson Avenue, Woodward Avenue, Gratiot Avenue, and I mean, you know, you'd have your rock music blaring, man, and it was just a special, I mean, you know, for rock and roll, I think it was almost, we took it for granted.
It was special all the way up until,
yeah,
probably the time we left, because I remember, if you look on the back of the Jay Giles album, called Full House, it was recorded in a place called the Cinderella Theater in Detroit. That's right around the corner from my mom's.
Yeah, that's right around the corner from where we used to live. We used to walk to the Cinderella Theater.
Did they, I'm sorry, I was going to say, I actually, not that I remember too much, but my family lived in Detroit about 1983, and we lived in Livonia. And I don't remember that much, and I don't have the kind of experiences that you guys do. I do remember it being, you know, a very working class town from my experience, and, you know, and that kind of bleeds through into the music as well, it seems like.
Oh yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Motown made a connection between the working people, because all the working people were either at the Ford plant, the Chrysler plant, the GM plant, or some kind of plant. Okay, that's the main job was in Detroit. And a lot of times, the entertainment industry, you would go right into the car factories. You know, when Martha Reeves and the Vandellas did it, and a few other bands did it, and, you know, it kind of connected the working people with the entertainment people, so it was, you know, it created a real party atmosphere, so to speak.
You know, when you guys first started out, you know, it seems like, you know, you were a part of... you know, so, I'm sorry, I don't know exactly how to phrase this question. What did you guys listen to growing up? That was what I was trying to say. Like, when you were growing up and you were kids, what were your interests in music? What were your parents' interests in music, your family? What did you guys listen to?
Oh, man. You know what? In the 50s, see, I was too young to remember because I was the youngest of the boys. But in the late 50s and right to the early 60s, my mom and dad tuned into what everybody else in America was tuning into, and that was really the Chess record label. There was Etta James, Chuck Berry, Howlin' Wolf, Little Walter, Muddy Waters. Of course, my mom, you know, they were very spiritual people, too, so there was a lot of Mahalia Jackson, you know, James Cleveland, gospel music, you know. But it was, I mean, you know, as far as dancing and as far as, you know, popular music, they tuned in to the whole Chess record label. So we grew up with a lot of those 45s. And I distinctly remember a lot of Etta James, because my dad was really big on Etta James, much to my mom's dismay. mean, you know, but, and my mom, you know, she really liked, a lot of the female singers. Like I can remember, you know, for the first time hearing Dionne Warwick, we didn't even really know who she was. You know, but, you know, at the beginning, a lot of Johnny Mathis and things like that. And so, you know, we grew up with a lot of music in the house. And my dad, he was a Baptist minister, but he was really in tune to a lot of history that was taking place. So naturally, of course, with the Civil Rights Movement, the March on Washington, and there was a lot of events. And, you know, the one particular event that he had us tuning into was when the Beatles came. In that electrifying weekend in February of 1964 when the Beatles first came on the Ed Sullivan Show. And, you know, that whole weekend was kind of like electric, and everybody in America knew it. And he had the inkling that this was being history. This was history that was being made. So he encouraged us to sit down in front of the big old black and white TV and watch the Ed Sullivan Show, man, that night, like everybody else in America did.
That's amazing that you guys were able to view that. I mean, what were your initial impressions of the Beatles?
Oh, man. Yeah. We went crazy like everybody else did. We wanted to play instruments.
Pretended to be Ringo Starr.
We wanted long hair. When my brother David saw that, you know, he was so influenced by it the very next day. He went out in the alley behind my dad's house and found a old beat up guitar and took some nylons and, you know, fixed up some strings on it. And we were kind of mimicking, you know, the Beatles, you know, we were just, you know, each one of us passing around the guitar, you know, imitating what we had seen on Ed Sullivan last night.
When I was a kid, I tried to, take a tennis racket and sit there, and my dad taught me how to put the record on the turntable when I was seven. So, you know, I remember putting on Sgt. Pepper and seeing George Harrison in that hat, and I'd put the tennis racket cover on my head and sit there and play along with the tennis racket to the album.
Same deal.
Yeah, same deal, man. Yeah, you know, it's funny. A tennis racket always did make good pretend guitars.
Oh, yardstick.
You know,
yardstick. Yeah. Yeah. Hockey sticks, tennis rackets.
Hockey sticks, yeah.
And
then there was all the brooms and the mops and, you know.
Well, and the nice thing about it is you could actually, you know, with the tennis racket, it kind of felt like you were playing a guitar too, you know.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. Well, it was sick like a banjo, so what else you need, you know?
See, that was easy for you guitar players to talk about. Us drummers, we had to go looking for TV stands and all kinds of things that were found on garbage cans.
Yeah.
But cardboard boxes, I did the same thing. Cardboard boxes, pots and pans. I drove my parents crazy until my dad finally got me a drum set when I was 11. So.
Wow.
That's
with my mom.
Well, that's, I mean, I talk about this stuff because, you know, one of the things that I took away from the movie, which was very personal for me, is my family also had my dad played guitar when I was growing up, you know, and dive bar bands and whatnot. And, you know, I was always around music, and my brothers were too, you know, and so that in the film, the story of you guys making music together, I completely connected with that. In a very emotional way. And I mean, I'm kind of choking it back now because, like, you know, my younger brother plays drums, my younger brother plays bass, and for a time we were able to put a band together, and it was a very short period of time, you know, before we got older and moved on. But I was just struck by, you know, how you know, much of a, because I know how much of a bond, you know, is created when you're in a band. It's like, it's a relationship.
Exactly.
It's a marriage. But then when you throw family in the mix, it's it takes it to another level.
Exactly.
Serious,
yeah. Exactly. And I think that's why some of the greatest bands you'll ever see and maybe yet to see will always be family oriented or connected. you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like our guitar player here, Bobby, who more or less has, you know, filled in with the place of David. He's worked with a number of notable brother relationships, you know? And the Poindexter Brothers being one of them. I mean, these guys wrote hits like, It's a Thin Line Between Love and Hate and all that kind of stuff. And Bobby could tell you a little bit about that, you know, about all that stuff.
Oh, yeah, starting with brother groups. Yeah, that seems to be my life, you know? My first group was the group Finger Licking Good with the Cox Brothers. Kenny and Nolan Ralph Cox. And then we were like 12, and that was actually my job at the time for the New York City Youth Corps to go around from borough to borough and play block parties, you know? And that's where I started. And then I worked with the Lean Brothers. I worked with the Poindexter Brothers, and I worked with the Abney Brothers now. There's a pattern there, isn't there? It's quite a pattern.
When Dennis and Bobby, when they first told you about Death or showed it to you, I mean, did you know about it when you were playing with them in Lamb's Breath? When did you know about Death at that point, or did you not know about it until everybody else found out?
Yeah, I was sort of like the latter. I didn't find out until everybody else found out. It was like a total surprise to me because about 7 years ago, I mean, we ran into each other in New England, and we just started covering original and original reggae sides, you know, and gigging around the states, you know, doing a lot of reggae with a group that were in by the name of Lamb's Breath, a very popular group in New England, started by the Hackney Brothers. And one day, Bob came downstairs with a CD and told me about the Death Project, and it's been fantastic since then. I had no idea that these guys played rock and roll. All these guys played for years, I had no idea. We'd always, like in rehearsals, we'd play Motown songs, Ray Kay songs, jazz songs. You know, rock and roll never even, you know, then one day, here comes Bob. Here comes Bob and Dennis with this stuff, you know, and it's really fantastic. It's actually an honor, you know, because
I guess you could say that the world is, we let the world in on a family secret.
It's an ancient family secret, you know, because it's actually an honor. I've always been like, in my mind's eye, as a child, actually, it's always been something very important to me to find out who the originators of something was. You know, I've always, like, I look at the liner notes on albums, you know, when you go to the stores, and I happen to run into the originators of punk rock, you know, so lucky me, you know what I mean? Lucky me.
How is it to, take a listen to the record, and then, and when you had to sit down and learn David's guitar parts, I mean, what was that experience like for you?
Well, it was, at first, it was like a trip for a minute because I had to kind of like go back to my 70s days also of playing Buddy Miles and Sly Stone, that type of thing. I had to get myself back in shape, you know, just through my head altogether. It's not a physical thing. I had to get my head into the rock and roll again and everything, but it's so much fun. It only took like a couple of minutes, you know. We got back into it, and wow, it's just been a trip. David, being an excellent player that he was, you know, he did pose a challenge at first because of his approach to, like any other guitar player, like when you hear somebody's other stuff, you know, they're doing something in their way. So I had to kind of like cop a lot of his moves first in order to really make sure that I was really doing justice to the songs, make sure they sounded the way, you know, that they sounded when we recorded, you know. And but since then, you know, I've brought them to the songs to myself, and we're doing it like breathing air now, you know. It's just like second nature.
Were Bobby and Dennis able to kind of tell you about the physicality? Because, you know, that's one thing that's very important about guitar playing. You know, everybody holds it differently, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, the physicality to it, everything, that was actually the major challenge, you know, because, you know, playing music, you know, all these years, I've been doing it, you know, just as long as Bob and Dennis have, but there's a lot more energy that's involved when you're playing rock. I had to get in shape.
You know, Dennis, after spending some time playing reggae, is just, it's not as intensive as the stuff from the Death record that you guys did. I mean, how long did you have to, like, you know, woodshed and really kind of get back into shape before you could go and start playing in front of audiences again?
That's the first thing I told Bob, is like, after we presented this stuff to Bobby Duncan, I said,
you know, I was looking at Bob, who's kind of looking at each other, like, man, we've been spending the last 20 years playing reggae. We gotta acclimate ourselves to this again. So, you know, I mean, we did it step by step, and, you know, we started with the easy stuff and eased into the hard stuff, and, you know, after a while, things, it's like riding a bicycle. Things start coming back to you, you know, and then you could, you know, make certain moves and things that, you know, because we were already used to, we weren't really music rusty. You know, it's just a genre of music that we hadn't played for a while, so we had to just, like, reacclimate ourselves to it. And, yes, because the thing was, when we first got into reggae, Bob had a really hard time convincing me that, you know, we could make a go at it of playing reggae because, I mean, you know, my drummers were like Carl Palmer from Emerson, Lake and Palmer and Keith Moon from The Who and you know, drummers like that.
Yeah.
You know, then I start listening to drummers like, you know, Sly Dunbar and other cats like that who played reggae, who was very much more laid back. You know, so I had to learn that laid back style and in order to play the music right. But, you know, it was a little transition, but we made it back to the rock and roll.
Yeah, but, you know, I had recently talked to Carl Palmer, and, you know, he was rooted in jazz. You know, so, I mean, there's like, I mean, the thing is, like, you know, your influence with somebody like Carl Palmer, you know, there's a precision there. So, you know, for, you know, a lot of reggae, you have to be precise and, you get Keith Moon, great drummer, you know, sometimes, you know, there's the energy that he put behind it, though, you know, caused it to be I'm not saying he was sloppy, but you know, it was definitely not as somebody as wasn't a precise drummer.
Right. Well, I mean, you know, I think it's a combination thereof because, you know, that could be said for all drummers. We get a little sloppy sometimes. We get smooth at other times. It depends on what you're playing. You know, like when I was playing reggae, I could just lean back and just concentrate on the beat.
Yeah.
And make a few accents, and that made the song. But in rock and roll, sometimes you have to use that reckless abandon and that, you know, to give your songs that edge. So, you know, I use the kind of sloppy thing. I kind of use the smooth thing and the precise thing. It's all a good combination of how you use it.
Has the exploration of music and the acts of creating new sounds, is it different now that you're writing new material than it was? And well, obviously there are some things that have changed, but how is it different for you?
Yeah, but well, I have to give you over to Bobby for that one because I'm not going to write.
Well, you know what? When you said, how does it feel to create this new music after so many years?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, the great thing about it is that during the 70s, you know, me and David, we wrote a lot of songs. And Dennis also helped us to develop a lot of these songs. So we have a good catalog of songs that I thought would never, I mean, they were just like, I don't know, you know, like family portraits to me, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, and just you just keep them and, you know, you remember them and, you know, and I never thought that I would be going into that catalog choosing songs to take into the recording studio, you know.
How many hours of demo tapes did you guys record back in the early 70s?
Hours and hours. David was a recording nut. I mean, David would record when me and Dennis, I would go to school and then I had a part-time job after work. Dennis would go to work. David would go right to the, you know, just the recording music. And he did that morning, noon, and night. We'd come back home and he'd still be working on, sometimes he would be working on one song throughout the whole day. And we would come back in the evening and he'd still be working on that same song. And so, you know, he was always, I think that's one of the things that has helped with the discovery of the music is that we all did, but namely, notably David left a lot of recorded songs and recorded demos. And, you know, we recorded a lot during that time. We couldn't play out live because we had so much rejection. So the only thing we could do was stay up in our room with all of our equipment and you know, practice and record.
Well, that's very profound. It's you know, David's still part of the band, you know?
Yeah, oh, definitely, and very much so. And we're fortunate to have a guitar player like Bobby who not only acknowledges David's spiritual presence, but, you know, he's a great songwriter himself, and he understands the value of basically, you know, the songs that we have in the catalog. And so the great thing is that we've completed a new album, and six of those songs are from the Death Archive of the 70s. And one of those songs we all collaborated on, and three of those songs Bobby Duncan has contributed out of inspiration for just being involved with the Death story and the inspiration of the music that he's learned since he's been doing this.
It's amazing. Yeah, I want to go back to you said just a minute ago that you had a hard time, you know, getting gigs and getting out there. I mean, I can understand that maybe it was difficult for people to accept your family getting into rock and roll and trying to make, you know, a name for yourself in rock music. But did you guys ever try and go out and connect with some of the rock and roll artists in your community?
Oh, yeah. Like you said, you know, half of Detroit was Motown, but the other half was Rock City. So, and David knew a lot of rock and roll guitar players that lived around the area of Detroit that played rock and roll. And, you know, we would go out, you know, to the areas and hang out with them. And, you know, we would show them what we're doing, and they would show us what they're doing. And, you know, but it was just on a quiet scale because nobody really had a contract or anything, so we didn't have that much to brag about. But like you said, we was trying to follow around, like do stuff like the MC5 was doing because they had a contract. They was the one going into Massimino Music and spending $20,000 a shot. You know, so we wanted to be like that. And, you know, that was the side that we hung out with. Of course, when I hung out with my mom, then it was always Motown and the Detroit Emeralds and Hugh Masekela and stuff like that because, you know, she would take me into the bars that I wasn't old enough to get into. And I would see these shows, you know, and then her boyfriend was the head of security at Joe Louis Arena, so I saw all the rock concerts and the wrestling matches. And all that kind of stuff. So I was very fortunate as a young teenager to have all of this at my access. So that's how we interacted as opposed to going out trying to find a gig because the couple of places that we tried to find gigs, you know, they didn't like the name. One place just came out and said, you know, whoever heard of a black rock and roll band? And, you know, when they finally gave us a gig, it would be on a Monday night. It would be like three couples on the dance floor. You know, so, like you said, essentially all we had to do was hang out with our friends and in our own room. And, you know, that's what we had to do back in Detroit, you know, when it wasn't going to the auto shows. And, you know, because that's what we would contact bands like, you know, Bob Seger and the Last Herd, you know, and, you know, I mean, we was just running around Detroit doing whatever we could do and seeing whatever we could see especially if it involved music.
Yeah. You know, I think that, you know, one thing you probably have talked to your sons and Ruff Francis and stuff like that, you know, the music scene is different now, you know, in terms of like, you know, with young kids coming up, they have stuff like Bandcamp. They have, you know, the opportunity to, I know a lot of people, they just do house shows and whatnot. I mean, it and you guys did kind of your garage shows and whatnot. I mean, it must amaze you guys, you know, like how much is at people's disposal now, or young kids, you know, to go out there and create music and get it out to the public.
Well, that's good, because I mean, Ruff Francis, they kind of keep us in the know of what's going on, you know? And, you know, I'm glad that it's easier for them, because if it's not easier for them, then all the crap we went through would have been for nothing, right?
Yeah. Do you think that there is still a bias towards black rock and roll artists within the African-American community these days?
You know what? We never really tuned into that, man, because, you know, in the 70s, what we really tuned into was, well, we knew that Jimi Hendrix had went through even some of that same type of stigma. There was groups like the Chambers Brothers. Of course, you know, see, but the great thing about our era is that as we was growing up, coming into teenagehood, in 1968, something remarkable happened that had never happened before. There was this group called Sly and the Family Stone,
mm-hmm.
that came out with, not only were they young, but they had women in the band, they had families in the band, they had, it was a multiracial band, so it crossed genders, and, you know, it was, I think that was the reason why they were a big popular band at Woodstock, because they kind of, and people to this day say that Sly and the Family Stone represented what Woodstock was all about, which is what, peace and love, trying to be together. You know, I mean, it wasn't really a racial thing with rock and roll. It was really, the enemy was Nixon, man, and the establishment. The enemy was Vietnam. The enemy was the government, man. Power to the people. You know, I mean, that's what we were tuned into, and that's what attracted us. One of the things that really attracted us to the rock and roll movement was really the Woodstock. I mean, you had Monterey Pop Festival, where you had Janis Joplin and Otis Redding on the same stage with Jimi Hendrix. I mean, and so that was really, it was the peace and love movement. And it was the hope that, you know, I mean, even though that hope got dashed, that was the big hope of the time. And I think that's what really influenced us to gravitate to rock and roll.
And those guys did their job. They flung the door open for us.
Yeah.
Okay, that's why we're able to stand and say, well, the racial thing doesn't matter. Well, this doesn't matter. That doesn't matter. Because they opened the door for us.
And if you really want to know the truth about the racial thing, what happened with them, we never got nearly as much as a racial stigma from the white community as we did from our own black community.
That's what I was wondering, is that, and that was like the question is, like, is there still that bias for,
not now, because now, you know, we go back to Detroit, and now even some of the older people who were growing up with us at the time were like, wow, we just didn't know, and they're like, wow, you know, now they want to adopt us they're proud of us now, but at the time they was like, you guys need to shut up with that stuff. You need to play some James Brown or Earth, Wind and Fire or the Isley Brothers or some Motown, and you know, they would tell us that it's bad enough that you guys are black, but your name is Death. You know, so that's what we went through, even in our own black community. The one gig that David tried to set up for us was at a place called the Masonic Temple. And, you know, this was like an all-black cabaret, you know? And, I mean, you can imagine a packed hall of people. Nobody's on the dance floor, and we're up there doing our rock and roll numbers. We're playing Great Balls of Fire and Johnny Winter songs, and then we do our Death stuff, and after each song it was like silence. You could hear a pin drop in the place. And wow. You know, finally after one of our songs, an old guy just got up and walked across the dance floor, And he whispered to us, he said, "You're too loud." And he just walked back and sit down. And, you know, that was the kind of reaction that we got.
Yeah, well, that's the story of rock and roll. You're too loud.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, gentlemen, I'm afraid we're going to have to go ahead and wrap this up. It's been an honor to talk to you, gentlemen. You know, Bobby,
hey,
Dennis,
thank you so much,
Bobby. Everybody needs to go out and watch this movie. Either see it in the theaters at the end of this month, on the 28th, or watch it online now. Amazon Instant Video, iTunes, YouTube, Google Play, Xbox Live, Vudu. Go out, watch it. It's an amazing story, gentlemen. Thank you very much for
thank you
for bringing your story. Like I said, very very inspiring and touching, and can't wait for the new album.
Well, you growing up and you being in Michigan, that gives us a connection to you, man, a special connection, and we just want to say thank you very much.
And tell your listeners, thank you for bringing back Death.
A Band Called Death is available on iTunes, Amazon Instant Video, and other VOD outlets for viewing now. Go watch it now. I highly recommend this. It's really good. You know, like I said during the interview, it really connected with me on many different levels. And I think that people who love music and also have a bond with their family through music and vice versa will really get a lot out of it. And if you don't even have that same kind of experience, then I suggest you watch it so you can see what family and music and, you know, that relationship is like. Check it out on abandcalleddeath.com. Please go to that website for more screenings of the film in your area. Like I said, beginning Friday, June 28th, they'll start doing those around the country. You can also pick up the record for the whole world to see. It's available on dragcity.com. For download, and also for you can purchase it on vinyl, I believe. So that's pretty freaking cool. You can find us at sockmonkeysound.com, where there's an archive of our past episodes with the likes of Ian MacKay of Fugazi. You can listen to him tear me down. That's pretty awesome. Amy Milan, David Bazan. We've done a couple of really good ones with him. And John Worcester of Superchunk as well. So there's other local, regional, and national artists as well in our archives. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Google+. You can listen to the archive of past episodes on our website, sockmonkeysound.com. Or you could go to the free iTunes podcasting app, download that. You could listen to the show via that. Just do a little search. And now we have shows available, more recent episodes available on Stitcher Radio. If you haven't heard of Stitcher before, it's an award-winning app. With Stitcher, you can listen anytime and anywhere. You don't need a Wi-Fi or cell connection. You could get the latest episodes faster on Stitcher, where the shows, they update, and there's no downloading or no syncing. And you don't have to worry about, you know, 40 gigs of Sock Monkey Sound taking up space on your phone or whatever. Connect with your Facebook account, and you can comment on episodes. And I tell you what, we would like to see some comments. That would be really cool. You know, reviews, iTunes reviews, those help out a lot. And then also now you could comment on Facebook via the Stitcher app about episodes of Sock Monkey Sound. It's available for iPhone, Android, and most tablets, and you can download it for free. Free is always good. Once again, thanks a lot for listening to Sock Monkey Sound. My name is Chip Copeland. We'll check you later. Bye-bye.